Okay, so now we officially jump back into the Gemara. So in Talmudic fashion, we're going to begin tonight with what we call Chazara. Lachazor, we return. So Lachazor, we make Chazara. We always return back to what we learned before in some which way, shape, or form. Sometimes directly back, so we get ourselves really owning what we had already talked about, and then we push forward and add new dimensions to what we learned before in order for us to go even further ahead. So we're going to do a little of that tonight, because what we have here in Chapter 8 at the beginning of the chapter we're learning is what we're going to refer to all the time as our Mishnah, and we need to know what our Mishnah really says, and we need to kind of slice it, dice it, and understand it in the various ways, and sometimes your questions will send me back into certain sources so that I could elucidate a little bit more what it is we brought up by way of conversation based on some of the learning that we do together here. And so I found a couple of those spots that I'm going to also add to. But if you recall, we ended last time with a question of sorts, and that was, I asked the question, why we didn't get an exploration of Arve Yoma, of what's going on Erev Yom Kippur on the 9th, especially if I had a verse that I had to explicate from Torah that said, Shabbat Shabbaton hu lechem ve'initem et nashotechem. It's a Shabbat of Shabbats for you, Shabbat Shabbaton. We'll learn in the Gemara down the line a little bit what will come around that phrase and that phrasing. Ve'initem et nashotechem, that was the operative term and terminology to begin discussing inuye nefesh. Those are the afflictions of the soul that we call the practices of Yom Kippur that we named when we started brainstorming or remembering. What do we do for Yom Kippur? Fasting, don't eat, don't drink. We looked at the list. But tisha lechodesh be'erev me'erev. And then it said the 9th of the month. And we asked, so what's with the 9th? And we understood from that al pi halacha, according to Jewish law, there is a very, very big dimension of preparation and eating on the 9th that is, according to tradition, accounted to us as if we fasted on the day we needed to fast, meaning that the eating of the 9th is a fast. And we said, boy, how Jewish. That it was an unbelievable statement that fasting is is eating, and eating is fasting, right? And only by the Jew, only the Talmudic way of thinking. But the reality is that what it meant is that it's considered inui of certain sorts. And even though we have a great meal and we have a tasty meal and we prepare a banquet of sorts and we really eat in order to physically get ourselves set to do the act of anti-eating or fasting, what we're really doing is really affording ourselves a meal that has, in a certain way, the stitch of wisdom in it that says, you're doing this because you're remembering what it's like to be a human being, what it's like to be basar vadam, flesh and blood. You're doing this for the purpose of really filling yourself with your humanity, because tomorrow you're going to have a very different experience of being on the earth. Tomorrow you're going to have a very different experience of being on the earth. And even though it kind of stays there and it helps you get through, the idea is that, no, you don't have this kind of freedom. And we're going to express our devotion. We're going to use the fast in whatever way and language. We're going to talk a little bit more about the language and scholarship of fasting tonight through an article that I pulled out for us from the Harvard Theological Review. But that you're going to have a very different experience of this, and of this inui, of not the fast per se. So I want to clarify, of course, we knew that. But the eating is part of the inui. The eating is part of la'anodet nafshoteich. The eating is part of the kind of working on the soul level to really engage the holiday. By the Hasidim, and sometimes we'll jump all the way up to, you know, in Jewish history, we're really flying through time sometimes. So hang on, right? So we were in the Gemara, which we said was the project of around the year 200, post the Mishnah being edited by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi in the year 200 CE. in Israel. The Gemara project happens, this Gemara that we're learning, and really what we call the Gemara, is the Babylonian Talmud, 2nd century all the way maybe through the 8th century. The Hasidim, when we talk about Hasidic texts of great importance that set out a new way of looking at Torah, Halakha, Jewish practice, we usually talk about the late 18th century and 19th century books that define that movement in terms of the wisdom of the Beit Midrash, in terms of the literature we read together to really get a sense of Hasidic literature. There are some books of the 20th century that are powerful commentaries on Torah as well that we mine from now and then and that we have mined from here on Shabbat. For instance, one year we studied deeply the Slonimer Rebbe, who was a 20th century, writing in the 20th century, versus, let's say, the Kedushat Levi, Rebbe Levi Yitzchak of Radichev, who is really a Hasidic master of the 19th century. And when I say Hasidic literature, I can even talk about pre-Baal Shem Tov, in my estimation, the mystical halachic literature that's taking from the world of mysticism and adding a dimension to our everyday Jewish lives. I'll call it Hasidic. There's a little debate. Where does this really fit? This is a mystical commentary, the one I'm about to share now. It's more 16th century than the Hasidic proper, world of Hasidic proper literature. But the Shlah, Rabbi Isaiah Horowitz, really you could say, is a primary source of inspiration for some of the late 18th century Hasidic masters, because he's dealing with a mystical overlay on our everyday activity in a little bit more of a popular form or digestible format than some of the deeper and really, really intricate, in terms of ontology, in terms of cosmology and mythology, Kabbalistic and mystical literature that tried to do a little of the same. All that to say, we sometimes are going to look at some of these sources that come from different genre episodes of our history. Rabbi Isaiah Horowitz is writing in Poland and distributing commentary that's very mystically oriented and very Hasidic in its nature. And when I say the word Hasidic, it means a new way of looking at Torah, not having to only rely on classic Midrash, but using concepts from within our tradition, even mystical traditions or more cosmological kind of conceptions, to make understandings of what our general Jewish practice looks like. Because any mystical, Kabbalistic or Hasidic life, in terms of the literature, reflects a commitment to the ritual life that we're talking about in our Mishnah and Gemara. There's a direct bridge, and we always have to remember that. So the Shlah says about the ninth day and what we do with the eating on the ninth day before the tenth, that is Yoma, Yom Kippur, the following. So he says, Zelashona Elohi Meharav Moshe Cordovero. This is the language of Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, the great 16th century student in Sfat of the Arizal of Rabbi Isaac Luria, B'Sefer Avodat Yom HaKippurim, in the book that he wrote concerning the worship that we do on Yom Kippur. Derech Kol Yisrael, it's the way of all Israel, Lismoach Be'erev Yom Kippurim, to actually be in great joy on the day before Yom Kippur, Lismoach, to make it like a mean simcha, to make a little simcha on that day. Ulitaken su'uda yafa, really it should be, and to create a beautiful meal on the ninth. V'chein adin, and that in fact is the Jewish law. Make a really beautiful meal. V'chein pershu b'gemara, and as it's said in the Gemara, v'omnam ta'am l'ze yitba'er b'mashe hikshu b'zohar. And as we learn in the Gemara, that's the Gemara we looked at, right? What's the Gemara say? On that day, the ninth, when you ate, it's as if you also fasted. We're going to account this for some inui, some real worship of this day that you need to do to make Yom Kippur really come true, to live out all the verses of the Torah that we studied last time. Ki hatshuva hi achat mi mitzvot aseh. This is what it says in the Zohar. Uvachol mitzvot aseh tzarich hasimcha. Because the Zohar is going to give us some sense of why it is. And now let me tell you, from what we learned in the Gemara, that seems like it's inui, it's affliction, and that there was a little bit of that already beginning affliction. It says in the halachic codes, lismoach, it says in the Jewish law codes, to be in joy. Why would it say be in joy to make this meal if, in fact, it's la'anodet hanefesh, it's to make an affliction of the soul? Again, getting into this word affliction. Well, that's because, the Zohar says, tshuva, which is a mitzvah aseh, tshuva, and there are two categories of mitzvah in general terms, we're always going to categorize things using rabbinic constructs, right? And Torah constructs. There's a mitzvah aseh, which is a mitzvah that is positive and that you must fulfill. And there's a mitzvah lo taseh. There's a mitzvah that you have to refrain from doing something, right? So in this case, the Zohar comes to say, tshuva is a mitzvah aseh, and it needs simcha. Every mitzvah aseh that we do needs some level of simcha. Just really an interesting concept if you take that to the extreme. Because there are lots of positive mitzvot that we do that, A, you're not awake for and you don't know where to find joy. Or you really have a mitzvah to do, and it could be an aseh mitzvah, and it's about kavod ha-meis. I mean, it's about kavod ha-meit, which is the respect you have for a dead body. But that in a certain way, what's the portion of simcha that you're supposed to find in any of those mitzvot that seem really difficult to do in your life? Maybe that you were given an inheritance and a way of doing and a way of being that allows you to express your humanity, to express your connection with God, to express a Torah connection. Maybe the simcha is such a level that it really relates to simcha shel mitzvah in the kind of conceptual way that Max Kedushin talked about it in rabbinic value concepts. That if you live life with the simcha that we're talking about back from the time that it was discussed at first, you really are talking about a great joy of having the inheritance of Torah and having the inheritance of such a mitzvah like tshuva, because we're completely joyful in somewhere deep in there that we have a God who would forgive us, that tshuva is possible. You know, tshuva might not have been possible. Then what would we do? You know, that kind of joy. V'im kein chashav ha-betshuva ikaro hachna avadaga. And you might have thought that the essence of tshuva, of repentance, was really humbling oneself and lowering oneself and worrying, will God really take me back? V'im kein simcha b'tshuva hayach. And you might worry, how am I going to have any simcha toch kedei tshuva, within the experience of tshuva? But tertzu sham v'atali yenenu nomar ki yom kippurim ein bo simcha mechamat da'agot ha'avonot. And on top of that, the tenth day, the Yom Kippur day, is going to also cause you some great concern because you're bringing all these sins before God and you're worried about the transgressions. Ve'enei kol Yisrael hem tuluyim la'avihem shebashamayim. And you're totally dependent on God above to forgive and to really provide you for the forgiveness. Lirot shiyotzi la'or mishpatam. You want to know what's the judgment here. Ve'ein simcha. And you say to yourself, whoa, there's really no simcha in this. L'chein, thusly, where do you find simcha in the whole Yom Kippur experience? Hikdimu ha-simcha el ha-mitzvah. You have the simcha that you need to create at the ninth day meal before the entire experience of the Yom Kippur kind of deep tshuva and worry and the bringing yourself b'hachna'ah humbly before God with all of the list of transgressions and sins you have. L'chein, therefore, ra'ui l'takena bayit v'shulchan malei birkat Hashem. Therefore, one should clean the house, fill up your table with a bountiful meal, be'erev yom zeh, on the ninth day. Lismoach bo simchat mitzvah. And to really focus on that meal as a mitzvah meal. Uchenegid ze amru b'gemara, and that's why it says in the Gemara, kol ha'ochel v'shotei b'tshi'i, all those who eat and drink on the ninth day, ma'alin alav ke'ilu hit anat tshi'i v'asiri. It's said as if the person fasted both the ninth and the tenth. So you fast on the ninth and the tenth if you eat a meal in great joy on the ninth. Now we've even expanded what we're really saying about the meal on the ninth. And so that's the Shla. That's Rabbi Isaiah Horowitz. On a very pragmatic basis, he's also reminding the Jews, like, don't just run in for Kol Nidre. And don't just run in and have 15 minutes of make this a yuntiv meal. The ninth day. Make this for real. The time that you're really going to have this deep joy. And bring the simcha to the picture of Yom HaKippurim. And then he'll go on to say that the Yom Chi'i, the ninth day, to now get it into deeper mystical or cosmological reality, the ninth day and the meal on the ninth day before Yom Kippur is the reminder of your Olam Hazeh experience, which is this world and all of what we understand to be reality as we understand it in its great oneness that we can comprehend yet in our individual states as embodied human beings. And Yom Kippur becomes a place in our world, though it's in our temporal time-space, of Olam Haba, of the next world. And that if one celebrates correctly on the ninth, you can have an experience of this world, and the tenth, through the ritual acts that you will engage, that we've studied in our Mishnah, an experience of Olam Haba. An experience of the world to come on earth.
Does anybody talk about the feeling at the end?
We'll definitely get to the end, but we just started celebrating Yom Kippur, Bobby.
Oh, no.
Well, I think that celebratory meal on the ninth would be great if we didn't have to be in shul according to
that. but here's the challenge, right? Because everybody's thinking about, what are you doing for breakfast? What are you doing for breakfast? What are you doing for breakfast? But there are some parts of the Jewish world, and I remember having this experience in Yerushalayim, which I loved. Amy and I were together, and we had this family I was living with a family, and they said, oh, you're definitely coming for Yom Kippur. Great! You're definitely coming for Yom Kippur. I figured they mean the breakfast, right? So I said, like, what time are you ending? And we have a little bit of communication gap going on here. I'm like, they're like, what do you mean, what time are we ending? Like, you mean, what time are we starting? Exactly. And I said, but you're going to be at a different shul than I am. I'm not with you. I'm not by you for Ne'ilah. I'm actually going to be at this other little... Ne'ilah? And since... This was a Haredi family, very, very ultra-Orthodox, who was trying so hard to be so kind, and they were so kind to me. They're like, Ne'ilah? Before you call Nidre? See, what they meant was, come for the meal on the ninth. Because they made a huge meal. Huge. And it was full of kind of like... just chanting this line from this part of the Machzor and remembering this prayer from Tashlich, and they kind of have this whole to-do around the ninth day. I grew up like I was drooling for the piece of pound cake and the orange juice. You know? I knew from. But I had no clue about this ninth day kind of production of simcha and an entire kind of yuntiv feeling that I was to create. And it's true, like, we run there, and we try to, quote-unquote, run the shul early. But in this way, it's kind of like the quip that I once shared about Friday Jews, right? Like, Yom Shishi Jew. We need Shabbos Jews, but we need Yom Shishi Jews as well. We need Friday Jews as well. And the Gemara is saying, we need Yom Kippur Jews, and if you want to add the dimension and know how to, like, really produce an engagement here with the Yom Kippur experience, be a Yom Chi'i Yom Asiri, be a ninth day and a tenth day Jew, and create this experience for yourself.
So, but they don't work that day, so they're not rushing from work to have a meal and sleep, right?
What they're encouraging is for us to live a life where we don't really work on those times and in those spaces where we need to achieve these things. Now, that's, you know, impractical, right? The early benchers in America said, you know, in English, songs that were directly related to the dilemma that people had, right? Like, ain't gonna work on Saturday, ain't gonna work on Saturday, going to shul to pray, ain't gonna work on Saturday. You know, because they knew that families were really going through great, great decision-making, like really heavy decision-making about whether or not we're going to continue to, you know, observe Sabbath or not. The rabbis are selling a culture. The rabbis are selling...
Technically, it's not a holiday until sunset.
Ah, but the idea here is that...
I got the idea.
No, but we've missed
we
that.
We don't have the timing.
No, but the idea here is not that it's a holiday just come sundown. The ninth day for the rabbis, though it's not in the Mishnah, because of the quip in Brachot and the way the codes developed the ninth day meal, that before the fast meal, Sudat Maseket, becomes essential to the experience if you're kind of living out what we know to be the textual reality, and for many, many communities, the mimetic kind of reality, the cultural reality of the experience of Yom Kippur. We don't have that in general, it's true. It's not a generalized kind of practice. Already we were off for 2 days of Rosh Hashanah and in Shul so long and all of that. But there is the sense, and this is why we look at the texts, right? There's the sense of expansion here of what's possible to really make the Torah verses come to life, which is their project. Bobby, because you actually had asked to now... Ninth day is over. We've eaten. Everybody feel good. You asked about fasting, and if anybody else was fasting in that time frame, we talked about the ritual of fasting. So I found a wonderful article that I wanted to relate to before we jump back into the text of the Mishnah again to do the quick chazara, the review. So there's a Harvard Divinity School in. October 2003 in the journal, David Lambert at Harvard wrote, with some great work done by some wonderful Bible scholars, an article about fasting in the ancient world. And I wanted to just share a couple of pieces of it before we push forward. He says, scholarship on fasting in the Hebrew Bible made a special use of classificatory schemes. In other words, we try to put a ritual like fasting into its schematic. For what was it used and how do we understand it? One, fasting was an act of mourning the dead. Number two, fasting was an act of penitence. Three, fasting as an auxiliary to prayer. And four, fasting was a preparation for encountering the divine. And what he reports on is that the custom of fasting is widespread among peoples at very different stages of civilization in the ancient world and beyond, that it seemed to be, in the way he'll then expand upon things, a way of praying, not though all the time so penitentially oriented, and that's his claim. Scholars have failed to recognize the essentially non-penitential nature of biblical fasting. in part because of misplaced dependence upon the standard classification schemes, and in part because of the pervasive use of fasting as penitence in the subsequent history of both Judaism and Christianity. Of course, the biblical evidence itself suggests at first glance an association between fasting and penitence. Crises in the Hebrew Bible often occur on account of sin. Does not fasting at a time of crisis communicate a contrite acknowledgement that one's affliction is a consequence of one's deed? Indeed, how can affliction cease if its cause is not removed? But then, we have people who use it in different ways, as in hunger strikers of the ancient world. And first and foremost among them is the biblical figure Hannah, used in rabbinic literature as a source for laws relating to prayer because of its detailed description of prayer. The Hannah narrative in 1 Samuel can provide our discussion with an in-depth example of the relationship between affliction and prayer, refusal to eat, until God provides an answer. Not that it stemmed from any kind of penitential place. And that also helps paint a picture of what fasting could very well have been in that time period.
Petitionary.
The afflicted person may indeed use the fast to make a petition. Another piece now. Afflicting oneself for revelation. Unseemly before fellow human beings, fasting is nevertheless potent in its ability to reverse the fortunes of the afflicted. But a late text also describing the fast of an individual that may perhaps approach a view of fasting as automatically effective is nevertheless illustrative of the weakness of this model when applied to fasting in the Hebrew Bible. At that time, I, Daniel, kept 3 full weeks of mourning. I ate no tasty food, nor did any meat or wine enter my mouth. I did not anoint myself until the 3 weeks were over. Following upon this extreme self-affliction, Daniel is vouchsafed a marvelous vision of an angel. So, in other words, this was a moment before, let's say, Daniel's complete demise, and all of a sudden, the revelation. And therefore, fasting and lack thereof food is bringing him towards this angelic vision. And there are those who will say that fasting provides for us the experience of being more angelic ourselves, and bringing ourselves into a world experience, though our feet are planted here still, of an angelic existence, so that we're closer to divine experience and even revelation on a personal level. Today, the revelation would not come in the form of angels sent to us personally, or God coming down in any kind of communicative form, a la a Sinai experience even if it was simply or only eruption of nature in all its grandeur with voices beyond and beyond nature. But that you will sense that you can achieve some of this if you take this ritual approach into your Yom Kippur approach, is the point of the identification of fasting with more than just penitential work. So now let's look at the Mishnah again. And what I want you to see, I actually copied this for you. I told everybody to get the Art Scroll because I really love the Art Scroll version. If you don't have that tonight, you're in luck. I mean, if you have that tonight, you're in luck. But if you don't have that, you're also in luck. Because I copied from this other version that we sometimes also use, and that is the Steinsaltz, the new Steinsaltz translation of the Talmud. This is the Koren Steinsaltz edition of the Talmud, coming out volume by volume on the schedule of Daf Yomi, of learning the daily page of Talmud. So we're up to Sanhedrin now, or we're finishing Sanhedrin, we're into the next one. And this is Yoma from when we learned it a couple of years ago already. And I copied for you the page with the Mishnah and a couple more pages, because I want you to see, sometimes they have wonderful drawings and inclusions of material culture from the ancient world. that helps us visualize what we're discussing in wonderful ways. So I wanted to pass around this page to review the Mishnah and the first part of the Sugya in the Bavli. Again, the Bavli being the shorter name for the Babylonian Talmud. So just to remind you, the 8th Perek, chapter 8, begins right after 7 chapters of descriptions of all the work in the temple. And then immediately turns, after those 7 days, turns to the rituals of Yom Kippur as we know them. So let's look at the Mishnah. Matnitin. That Mem Tav Nun Yud is the shortened version of the word matnitin, and that means, so we taught in the Mishnah. Yom HaKippurim Asur Ba'achila. On Yom Kippur, it's forbidden. Asur Ba'achila. It's forbidden to eat. Uvishtia, and to drink. Uvarechitza, and in washing. Uvasicha, and in anointing or smearing any oil or ointment on one's body. Uvani'ilat sandal, and in wearing shoes. Uvatashmish hamita, and in using the bed. That is the rabbinic euphemism for making good use of the bed. Okay, so conjugal relations as it's translated here. We said, "Va'melech va'kala yirchatzu et pneihem," the king and the new bride get to wash their faces. When we talked about that, was washing their faces with warm water and not cold. And there's a big debate about whether or not washing. If you look over to the right, bathing. Because bathing is usually done with water, a separate prohibition against smearing with oil had to be specified. Some authorities distinguish between bathing, which is prohibited for any purpose, and smearing oil on oneself, which is prohibited only for pleasure. So you see that the debate here is about particulars. So in this case, they may wash their faces on Yom Kippur. We're talking about water. And a woman after childbirth who's suffering, and we call her Vehechaya, Tin Ol Et HaSandal, she should be able to wear shoes. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer, that's a statement of Rabbi Eliezer, v'chachamim osri. But the rabbis prohibit these activities for the king, the new bride, and the woman, or is it only the last one, or is it the first two? We ask all kinds of questions based on our ability to be critical readers of Mishnah and understand that we're allowed to ask such questions about the placement of phrasing and really how it can help us make the Gemara come alive, because those are kind of, quote-unquote, the open doors to Talmudic discussion. Now, the one who eats ha'ochel kechotev ragasa, the one who eats a large day bulk of food, kamoha uchgarinata, its bulk, its weight, and its pit, including the pit, v'ashatem lo lugmav, and the one who drinks according to full cheekfuls of liquids on Yom Kippur, chayav. There's the word chayav, liable. Now that word is different, we said, chayav, than the word that forbids the list upstairs in the first part of the Mishnah. We said that the word asur, which is different from mutar, forbidden versus permitted, is different than the word chayav. Chayav meaning that one is obligated the punishment directly from the Torah, and we know for these that one is, because we studied the verses from the Torah, one is cut off entirely from the people if one transgresses these particulars, Hayav Karet. And so we get the exact amounts for eating and drinking, right? Chayav. Kol ha'ochlin mitzarfin lecha kotevet. All the eating you do join together to constitute the amounts, the weights that we have to consider. V'chol ha'mashkin mitzarfin limlo lugmav. All the, that's the liquids. Ha'ochel v'shoteh ein mitzarfin. But you can eat this much and drink that much, and it doesn't combine. So you don't count the liquid towards your weight and measure of the date with its pit, and you don't count any of the food itself, you know, in terms of filling up your cheeks with liquid. Did we deal with, on the bottom part of the Mishnah, any of the washing, bathing, smearing in oil, wearing shoes, and conjugal relations? No. We only dealt with eating and drinking, because we have to know the precise measures, even according to the Mishnah. We're interested in knowing about those two particularly, because it's going to turn out that those may have, indeed have, a unique status as being the ones that we're really concerned about in terms of your trespassing, in terms of your committing sins, and in terms of your potentially getting the punishment of karet, of being cut off from your people. And so those become, in terms of the Mishnaic focus, the ones that we're left with if we read this Mishnah and say, okay, so what must be the most important, right? Because there's all five mentioned, and there's a couple of exceptions, it seems, for the bathing and eating, and then you get down to the bottom. But what were we surprised about vis-a-vis the Mishnah itself and the eating and the drinking? It seemed to indicate that there's maybe some room for eating and drinking. What's that?
Eat less than a pit.
I eat less than a date in its pit. And maybe if you just need like little taste in your mouth, one could read the Mishnah and say, I could be a Mishnaic Jew. And wait a minute, I'm not even swallowing my gum. So maybe I'm going to chew a little gum. And then I could have a little, like, one bite of, a date sounds interesting, according to the Mishnah. So the Gemara is going to start, the Gemara of the Babylonian Talmud, is going to start by wondering about this last part of the Mishnah. Maybe because there is a little surprise in terms of the Gemara. Maybe because immediately someone who's interested in Jewish law needs to know, what does he mean, codifically? Is this just for anyone? So someone can say, let's look at the Mishnah. I'm chayav only if I eat more than it. I know it's forbidden upstairs in the top part of the Mishnah, so it's just forbidden up there. It's a different language. These are how people think if I'm really attentive to the Jewish legal terms that I'm dealing with. So, all right, I know I'm not absolutely cut off if I eat less than this. And it says forbidden upstairs, but what level of forbidden am I really talking about? And this is how Jews who care about the system might relate to a Mishnah like this, in terms of the care about the system of particulars of halachic discourse. Right? So that's an interesting kind of phenomenon here that we have to now understand. That's where from the Gemara is going to start. About a level of surprise, by the way, we heard a wonderful presentation, and I don't know if anyone remembers, our member, Chris Miller, who's a professor at CUNY, his second book, is about surprise in literature and the function of surprise as being an engagement kind of factor and allowing readers space to come into a story to find themselves, surprising, in that kind of surprise. There's lots of different kinds of surprise. He explicated that. I think in some part, what's going on in this Mishnah is that we're a little surprised. I was already surprised that there was nothing about the ninth day. Its starting place surprised me as a reader, knowing the verses of the Torah that we studied. And now I see this as being a little surprising. And what the Babylonian Talmud is, I think all beginnings are very important, so the beginning of the Gemara upon this Mishnah and what the rabbis discuss says something on a literary level. So you're going to see what they're most surprised about, and they're going to start a discussion about these small amounts and why things are forbidden and just how forbidden are they, and what are we talking about here by way of the level of their restrictions. And we're going to be, not maybe for some introduce again, but they use this opportunity to really put down on the table a rabbinic construct of levels of prohibition that is a famous construct for all those who study Talmud, and that is the construct of de'oraita and de'rabbanan. Those are Aramaic words for from the Torah itself, of the Torah, category of mitzvah, de'oraita, and de'rabbanan, meaning that on the level of figuring out the proof text and the source of this prohibition, or of this mitzvah, some are from Torah direct, and some are de'rabbanan, meaning on a rabbinic level of mitzvah. And they carry lesser penalties most of the time, or sometimes they create these categories, must keep something that's Torah, and you could be a little bit more lenient with something that's de'rabbanan. And this system works throughout the entire Talmudic project in order to help us decipher just how severe a penalty I might incur, or how much I should relate to this as being absolutely necessary by way of doing a mitzvah. You know, I'll give you, for instance, with Torah reading. Torah reading may or may not be every week 100% de'oraita. That we read the Torah in public and learn it comes from a mitzvah of actually learning Parsha, according to some sources. We learn the Sidra of the week. We learn the Torah section. So the question was asked, if I haven't done my Torah learning, am I allowed to read it along with the person reading it at the Torah and actually fulfill my mitzvah while that person's reading? Absolutely, it says. That may be. When it comes to remembering Amalek, reading that section of the Torah, and before Purim, remembering what Amalek did to us, hearing it out loud in shul, the maftir reading, de'oraita, that's a mitzvah. Because it says in the Torah, zachor d'Amalek, remember Amalek. That's very important. And that de'oraita creates in me, if I'm in the system, a much deeper obligation than something that's de'rabbanan. Thus far? Good?
Do you know factually when really they started to practice Yom Kippur in our history?
I'm not exactly clear. I don't think anybody's exactly clear on that, when this Mishnah, quote-unquote, you know, stems from. It's obvious that seven chapters of what we did in the Beit HaMikdash is really the bulk of this Masechta, this tractate, and that we get this chapter so that we can now have Yom HaLedorot, you know, Yom Kippur for the generations to come. The exact dates, unclear. Unclear. We know it's early, the liturgies are early, we know from the Masechet Ta'anit, from fasting, Rabbi Akiva is using fasting for praying for rain and for demanding that God pay attention to the land and the Jewish people. But I have not seen anyone say definitively, in terms of dating, when this is from, except to say that it's early.
What do you mean by early?
Before the temple is destroyed by several centuries.
So do we assume, because they describe how the high priest goes in, and, you know, with the bells and all of that, that everyone else may be fasting and doing something in atonement at the same time, that they are linked together?
Right. I mean,
we obviously have a day of atonement.
Right. So that's the general feeling, that there was a penitential sense among Israel when they actually started to do what's outlined in our chapter and talk about what we do exactly in terms of, again, Yom HaLedorot, Yom Kippur for the generations. Not exactly clear, but I could imagine it, Bobby. I could imagine that, yes, while it's going on in the Beit HaMikdash, we have Am Yisrael in their ritual glory, really doing their work.
And the fact that this follows a description of the temple also makes it appear as though it was going on at the same time.
Right, one could read it otherwise, but I think that, yes, it was included there to be part of everything going on, as opposed to, we now got to tack on a chapter to figure out what we're going to do with Yom Kippur now that we live in Yavne, and the temple was destroyed in 70, and we're sitting here in the year 180, 200. I could theorize, by the way, as I will share, that there were other ways of observing Yom Kippur that were going on that the Mishnah does not report. And if I ask that from even just a textual perspective, forget scholarly perspective, I have evidence that there were other elements of what we know about the time of the Mishnah and what they were doing, which I will share with you in a few moments, because I have the Tosefta and copies of a parallel text to this time of the Mishnah sitting right here that I brought for us today. To answer just that, like what were they doing otherwise? But again, I can't tell you exact dates of just when that started.
The Torah describes the fast. They said you shall not eat or drink anything. There must be a reason why the rabbis included this ability to eat a small amount or drink a small. They're making a point, and there's a reason for that. Maybe we'll get to it, I guess. But
you tell me if one comes clear to you. I'm not sure I know. A. B is, we looked at a psalm last time, and we saw in verse 13 of Psalm 35 that we understood the verb la'anot et hanefesh, initi et nashotech, or the inuyi hanefesh verb. This is the place that I brought to you, among others in the Tanakh, not in the Torah, that connected initi vatsom nafshi. I afflicted with a fast my soul. But we, when we looked at the Torah verses, interestingly enough, from Leviticus and from Bamidbar, we saw that it repeated la'anot et nashotechem 5 times. It never mentioned a single thing about fasting. The word tsom doesn't appear. It doesn't say lo le'echol, don't eat. It doesn't say lo lishto. So actually, internally to the Tanakh, I'm already with you that yes, we understand afflicting the soul as including fasting, potentially including fasting for Yom Kippur, but nowhere in the actual verses about Yom Kippur that we investigated did I find the connection of the word tzom to this verb, making that what's called intertextual midrash within the canon of the Tanakh itself. Ah, the rabbis must have understood that to make an inui nefesh means to fast. But didn't say it explicitly, where I expected to find it, or I would have expected to find it.
When you first said prior to the temple, are we referring to the first temple or the second temple? Initially I thought it would be the first temple, and now you're talking about the time of the Mishnah, which would be about the second temple.
I'm talking both. I'm talking like if the Mishnah records history of all time in both temples, first temple and second temple, then I know what happened in both. And I'm particularly attentive to the transitional moments of non-temple Judaism that happened post-70. So that's why I keep mentioning the second temple. But I am aware that there's a exilic community between the two, which we haven't mentioned yet, that might just have been where some rituals in our ritual life come from. Because we need to figure out, now that we're exiled post-First Temple, not yet back to Jerusalem, how to understand Torah and its commandments in our lives. And so I don't discount the fact that some of our rituals could have happened at that moment too.
What's surprised me is that this was contemporaneous with, you said, or this was before the destruction of the temple. Now, they just, I would have thought the motivation was to bring the temple ritual, even if it couldn't be enacted anymore in its physical form, by recalling what was done. That's the way I always read the, when, during the service when you go through the, right, that this is for the purpose of recalling what it was so that the ritual is done vicariously, rather, and in memory, and memory isn't lost. But I didn't, I wouldn't have thought they would have bothered to, I mean, the Kohanim knew the ritual, they were practicing it, but there wasn't any motivation for anyone else to do that until it was gone. That's what I would have thought.
I hear your thought. There is even a spiritual midrash that says, if you read this, and if you learn this, and if you proclaim this, and say this section of the Mishnah aloud, and run through the service with these words, and make this your liturgy, it's as if you have performed, Jewish people, the work of the temple. Those are there. What we know now, in terms of the Mishnah, and what it reflects, is that for sure it reflects some contemporaneous Jewish practice in more places and spaces of the ancient Israel Babylonia reality than we've thought decades ago. Only decades ago. Because of the discoveries we've made, both archaeological and rereading the Mishnah and the Gemara. I'll give you just one example. Because that really was kind of how, you know, that's how we grew up. The temple was destroyed in the year 70, and Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Mishnah, brought the sages to Yavne, and they decided on how to continue Jewish life. That could be just what some people still learn. The reality is, especially with regards to Moed, the section of the Mishnah and the Talmud that deals with all our holidays, and Brachot, which is the section that deals with liturgy, Ta'anit, which is fasting, we can now look at those and say, here were ancient practices of Jews ritualized in their formats, most likely, and the rabbis will say in Megillah, from the time of Mordechai, who was out there during the time of Artaxerxes and what was going on in ancient Persia. And they'll not only say that for the nostalgia's sake, I imagine, not heretical, absolutely wonderful historical, they were kind of wondering some of the same questions we have. Which community actually wrote this part of the Amidah? So amazing. We understand that synagogue life now, Professor Lee Levine at the Hebrew University, who dug the spaces and places and investigated this, can show you synagogue life that was for centuries before the destruction of the temple, alive and well. And in my liturgy class on Thursday mornings, when we studied the Shema and the Amidah, here was my quick theory, and then we'll get back to our Gemara. There were probably what I called shamanics, people who read Shema, and that was their liturgy. And there were probably Amidah nicks, people who said the Amidah and had a silent prayer with 19, 18 blessings and had a whole liturgy. And at some point, my conception is that they merged. But these are liturgy studies issues in today's world. In the academy and beyond, there are now more books about trying to understand where the ancient prayer rites are from and at what points in Jewish history they're from, even in the most Haredi worlds. And some of them are very open to entertaining that they existed while the temple was doing its work, which is a radical shift in only the last couple of decades from the very strong narrative that the temple was destroyed, the rabbis took Yavne and decided to create for us a religious law code that would continue our people on into the future. So those blurred moments of history, blurred hundreds of years, are really possible. Okay, so let's go back into the text. You see that wearing shoes is mentioned on the side? Before we get into the beginnings of the Gemara. So there's the ancient sandal found at Mitzada. Found at Masada. Doesn't look very much different than the ones that you can buy in the Shuk today in Jerusalem. That's exactly the kind of sandal that they still sell. So pretty amazing. And you asked me last time about if anyone had more than a couple of days for the new birth mother to wear her sandals. And so I went and launched into an investigation of Rishonim on that issue, because remember, the one who gives birth can wear the sandals. And the sandals weren't widespread, but they were in urban places, the Steinsaltz says in front of you. And here's what it says. Ad matai hi nikret chaya le'inyan zeh. The Rambam asks, so when is she really called a new birth mother? Mistaber shenikrei kein ad shloshim yom leilata. He affirms that it's 30 days. She's called a new mother for 30 days in terms of wearing the sandals on Yom Kippur. Kamoshi mevuar b'gemara. She'ein matbilin ota ad shloshim yom leilata mishum hatsina kashela. Because you don't have her have to go into cold water for that long either. She doesn't have to, you make sure that the water's hot for her for 30 days. You know, in the ancient world, they didn't heat up water every time they washed. But for 30 days, people really had to wash, had to make warm water for her. V'im kein, hu adin kan me'achar ve'atam shemuteret v'nilat ha-sandal, hu mishum tzina, kefi she'ibayla'ama, ha'itirah la'kein ad shloshim yom l'leirata. So it was basically 30 days. L'da'at v'ashiltot, and so we have this other source, the Shiltot, that brought that we're talking really about one who gives birth. Katava Or Sameach, this other authority wrote, the Or Sameach, he muteret tamid b'nilara sandal mishum shematsui shetitzarech lelechet leyeled. That she would be able to wear sandals all the time. Seems like what he's saying is all the time that she needs to walk to the child, to run to the baby. So, you know, if I translate that source most expansively, what I can pull out is that if the baby really is in need of the mom, then maybe there's space for permitting her to wear the sandals even if it's after 30 days.
That sounds like even longer. What's yelling? It sounds like if she may have to run after a little kid who's toddling.
Yes, it even sounds like that. I didn't want to be so expensive because I'm not that permissive.
Exactly.
That's like over a year.
Yeah. Okay. Ode Hevi Aran, Rabbeinu Nissim, Spanish commentator says, B'shem HaShiltot, in the name of the Shiltot, the Gaonic era. Post the Talmud, we have the era of the Gaonim, the great geniuses who live in Sasanian Persia as well. 8th to 11th century, let's say. 12th century, if we push it. 13th century, if you want to be a real, you know, somebody claims different than the most. So he says, Shiyoledet asura lehitanot kol shloshim yom leleta. That it's even forbidden for a new mother to fast 30 days after. Because what? Hareavon mazikla. The hunger will make her go crazy. Varan chalakala, but the Ran argued against that. Ran.
Yep.
B'chatav shedavka b'nilat ha-sandal shehu isur kal v'hekila alaya. But with regard to the sandal, he's really, really permissive. Avaba achila v'shtia shehem isurei karet. But with eating and drinking that hold the punishment of being completely cut off from your people, ein l'chalek aleya, ein l'hakel aleya, you can't be so easy and permissive. Kol shloshim yom, all those 30 days. Eila dina what? Ad shloshayom. The Ron is very, very careful to not even make it 30, says 3 days after she gives birth. 3 days. As if somebody read the sources wrong or incorrectly. But we get back finally to 30 in terms of the work of the sources, that 3 is simply too short, and all the people that you need to care about said 30.
So I just want to get the bottom line is the reason that you are allowed to wear shoes is because it makes it easier to negotiate rocky things and it's not as painful and it's easier to walk. Is that what?
Actually, their reasoning in most of the sources is because the cold floor is bothersome. But I imagine that it has everything to do with pebbles.
Usually Rosh Hashanah is winter in Israel. It's usually on the side of the
stone floors of some kind. It's not gorgeous mosaic, some kind of stone.
Or flattened out mud that was still just too cold. But I imagine there's rocks and pebbles. All right, since I mentioned this and we've talked about it, let me read you the beginning of the Tosefta's version. Now, the Tosefta is a same period as the Mishnah, a Tannaitic source, maybe a little later, includes some strata that are later because it gets printed in the back of the Talmud volumes as a comparative text, as an additional text that we normally include. The great work on the Tosefta was done by Professor Lieberman at the seminary. And we have not only the Tosefta as it exists kind of in print in the normal version, we have Tosefta Kifshuta, we have an entire exploration of the manuscripts of the Tosefta that exist, and what was really in the earliest ones and what's in the later ones, and just a fantastic amount of scholarship at the seminary.
So when somebody says there's a Braita, does that include Tosefta?
Okay, so what's interesting is this. So the question is about the term Braita. In the Talmud itself, we'll hear that the Braita comes to challenge a Mishnah sometimes, or challenge an Amoraic teaching. A Braita, translated literally, means an outside source of the Tannaitic period, meaning the Tannaim, were the ones who wrote the Mishnah. But they were also people who had other texts, left some on the cutting room floor, as we like to say. And they created the Tosefta. It could mean that the source is going to be found over there in the Tosefta, now and then. But most of the time, or let's say just the same, it's a text that's from the same age that didn't make it into either the Mishnah or the Tosefta. Okay. Yom HaKippurim. On Yom Kippur. Here's the Tosefta. Asur. It's the same language of forbidden. Ba'achila uv'shtiya, b'rechitza uv'sicha uv'ne'ilat ha-sandal b'tashmish ha-bita. Okay. So thankfully we have the same. And then it says, afilu b'anfalia shel beged. You Jewish wise guy thought that it said don't wear a sandal. So therefore, what did you wear? What did you put on your feet?
A coat.
Sneakers.
What sneakers in the ancient world?
Fabric shoes.
You wrapped your feet up in cloth. You put socks on.
You beged is cloth, is that? Beged is cloth.
So, but on falia shall beged, it means cloth. But so you thought it said, and because it said sandals, you went and you put on socks. I'm telling you, not even socks. Now, here's interesting. Cuts right to the chase with children. Kitanim, children of non-bar bar mitzvah age, mutarim bekulan. It's okay. They're permitted with all of them. Of course, it's not talking about the use of the bed in the way that we're talking about. But it is saying that children, everything's permissible. Ah, the asurim b'nei lara sandal, but they're forbidden to wear sandals. Mibnei marid ayin. Because then it looks like everyone can wear sandals. Because maybe there's going to be some tall children, who knows. And you're thinking it's okay to wear shoes. So, lovely question to come. Right? This is the kind of question that we ask in the Beit Midrash as well. So why the immediate turning to the attention about children in the Tosefta and the lack of attention or the difference in text in the Mishnah?
You mean from the difference between the woman after childbirth as opposed to the children, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about two very different first Tanaitic teachings about Yom Kippur. Not that you won't get to these in the Tosefta, the ones in our Mishnah, but why the immediate attention to the inyan, which is the issue of the inyan of children?
Because it's not in the Mishnah, so they immediately stop.
Ah, so maybe the Tosefta is in dialogue with the Mishnah and tries sometimes to be a secondary text in the great law schools that were around at the time. Maybe the Tosefta is indeed in dialogue with the Mishnah. There is a scholarly debate about what the Tosefta really is. Is it a companion text to the Mishnah and tries to explicate and corroborate and add little new dimensions to what we're talking about in Mishnah? Or was it a separate text that completely grew up by itself and they didn't know from the Mishnah? So yes, possibly. But maybe they didn't know from the Mishnah and this is their version in the space and place where they learn Tosefta.
Well, do they mention the mother? If they don't mention the mother at all, then you would think that this is additional. But if they do this and then mention the mother, then you would think it was maybe their particular take.
Gotcha. About the Chaya, you mean?
Yeah.
If they don't really address her? Yeah, they'll address her.
Okay.
Why does the Tosefta say that can't wear the shoes to the child because it would seem that would be all right, but approving all the eating and drinking and washing, and wouldn't that be seen the same way?
It's really interesting, right? I mean, I might expect eating or maybe like only eating a little or a lineup of the times that they can't eat and then educating them towards eating. Well, if I look closely at the word kitanim, I might have some clue as to the time span I'm talking about in a child's life. So I'm not talking about maybe a na'ar, which is a youth. Maybe I'm only talking about kids who are up to age 5. If I start defining those terms, reading in other places in the halachic sources, then I get a better sense of whom I'm talking about. But the question still becomes, like, why the sandal in particular?
Do you think a 5-year-old could be confused with an adult?
No. I wouldn't think that motivation is the motivation. Right, that other explanation doesn't come to answer.
Yeah, but there is one difference, I think.
What?
And that is that eating and drinking are a natural instinct. And I could well imagine that if there's some food someplace around, it may not be fair to demand of a child that they refrain from doing those things. And also putting on shoes may be an act that requires the parents.
The other possibility.
If I may. That, on that last point,
yeah.
Just to tell me what you mean.
Well, maybe there's something inherently the parent actually has to do something in order to help the child get shoes on.
Okay, and that would mean what in terms of the reasoning?
Label.
And it, first of all, an adult has to be involved in the process. And also, I think eating and drinking is fundamental to survival.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas if the child just doesn't walk around so much because it hurts to walk around,
mm-hmm.
Maybe that's something that someone thinks is okay to withhold from a child.
I gotcha. Okay, hold the thought. This part of Professor Lieberman's work is an expansion on the Tosef and brings some halachic outcomes, reasoning outcomes, and I think it would be an interesting comparison between what you're saying in terms of reasoning and what this says.
Now, another thought occurs to me is that eating and drinking, though it doesn't specifically say it, is something that might more likely occur in the home, in private. Whereas wearing sandals is most likely out of the home and public.
Okay, so the public-private piece could very well be at play.
So that there's no, if eating is understood to be done in the home, then you're not risking the same kind of public, misleading the public
mm-hmm.
as you would in wearing sandals, which we suppose
mm-hmm.
is.
Are you reading that as confusion or envy tomorrow night? Because that to me is sort of the confusion. I mean, I can understand why the Tosefta, or I can theorize why the Tosefta is adding this little part in order to draw. You wouldn't expect the Ketanim would be obligated in any of them. But they're saying there is this one exception, which is that they shouldn't do. And for the reason is sort of expanding.
Yeah, the reason that...
I'm saying is because publicly it will... It would not be...
It will cause some confusion.
Well, I don't view it as confusion.
So well, so what? How would you translate Mari Dayan then, if you're not going to say it's going to publicly cause some confusion?
Well, maybe envy or...
Envy.
Yeah. But that part is sort of confusing because I...
Well, that part
I just don't get it.
That part is really not totally... absolutely gettable, right? We don't have an official translation or a commentary on the Tosefta, by the way. And we have some people who've done some work on it. So we have to really decide what it really means to us, sitting right here. Mari Dayan generally means that if I walk in, let's say you see me in the McDonald's buying a cup of coffee, and you say, oh, Bolton eats at McDonald's. Everything here must be kosher. And then you get the fish fillet. Because, no, you actually buy a hamburger. Because you thought it was kosher. Oh, boy. I mean, what trouble. That's Mari Dayan. And so the Tosefta is saying, if you let your kid wear a sandal... despite the fact that he can't be confused as an adult, it's going to cause some serious confusion. And you're going to think it's okay. Maybe it is about the envy. Because little kids who come in with wearing their good old regular shoes and they don't have special yontif shoes, maybe it will just cause either envy or at least confusion. I'm thinking about it from the experience that people have, that people see the children wearing this. And then it is more public. For sure, the eating is done more privately by way of our practice and could be done more privately because you have to be at home to do such things. They don't talk about public-private.
But the problem is if you don't have the kid with the shoes because you can fit him only at home, so if the kid is at home, it doesn't matter if he has shoes or not. So this whole argument is not...
It's not simultaneous. The kid is eating at home, but then he goes out.
If you bring your kid to shul and he's 3 years old and he wants something to eat, you'll give him to eat. That's it. Even in shul. So that's the way it goes.
You pretty true. I would think that's true.
Listen, I'm not sure exactly what the Tosefta is trying to teach us with the Mari Dayan piece with kids, except to say that jealousy or desire would rise in the eyes of other Jews, including adults, is the general point of Maridayim. Interesting, and probably because it is a public act, and that there really is a public element to this, and children will be out there. Listen to the next part of it. Just based on time, I'm going to read you one line. There's a story that Rabbi Akiva would have Beit Midrash time for the children in the Tosefta, and that he would ask the parents to come to the Beit Midrash, where he was saying the Maftir. Right? He was up at the Torah there. And he wanted the children, obviously, to hear it. And then he would tell the parents, go feed your children. Here's about the food part. So it may not have been so private. Ma'ase b'shmaye hazaken. There was once an episode in history where Shmaye Hazaken. No, not Shemaya, not Hillel and Shammai. But Shmaye Hazaken, the elder Shmaye. Shelo ratza la'achil et beno. That on Yom Kippur he didn't want to feed his child. V'gozru alav, and they decreed a decree against him, v'hechilu b'yado. And they made him feed the child right then and there. So serious was the Tosefta about the permissiveness. Even, it sounds like, in front of everyone, to make sure the children were taken care of, that there was a serious, serious push. And this is the beginning of the Tosefta, as opposed to our Mishnah. Uveshelat Rav Moshe mipuntizo. So we have a question, halachic question. I'm not sure exactly what year this is, but it's reminding me of Middle Ages questions. Rabu Ovde Elokim v'hamit parshim b'tahara u'v'frishut b'Yisrael v'einam rotzim l'hachil et b'neihem haketanim b'yom ha'kippurim. So religious became so many among those people in Israel and deeply concerned with Yom Kippur's power that they did not want to feed their children, their young children, on Yom Kippur. Afal pi shelo higiyu l'chinuch, even though they were small and hadn't arrived at an age where it's the age to educate them already. And that's also from the Tosefta that said 1 or 2 years before the fast. We should start educating the kids towards being able to handle the mitzvot of don't eat, don't drink. The Alma Hamachilin Omrim Shehem Ovrim Belov. And we say definitively that they are transgressing a lo ta'aseh mitzvah. We even categorize it as we have a mitzvah that you are transgressing. So, just an interesting piece about where the Tosefta starts versus where the Mishnah starts. And we make sure that we have this really, really powerful day. You know, and I brought you the Isaiah Horowitz. So powerful it is, it's like Olam Haba, right? Except the Tosefta reminds you, you live in this world, you have little kids, feed them. Right? You don't forget that stuff. What a mix of messages and what a mix of experiences we have as Jews. This high supernal world view, beyond this world view, and yet the very real kind of experience of being a parent. and the chiyuv, and you know you shouldn't worry from it. It goes on. I can't even touch it. That's forbidden. No, no, no. All we said is you don't eat.
There's also something else that says one does not. If you find laws, it's because there are things the law is trying to stop of some significance. So when that tosefta or where that tosefta was written, that must have been a major issue. Children not being...
Right, one philosophy of law is that law is in response to certain practices.
Right.
And maybe there was a community who felt as though, you know what, the children shouldn't eat either. But here the children were definitely fit. And by authority's measure.
I was going to say the same thing, that, or ask it as a question. Are they responding to local issues as opposed to setting some grand scheme?
Yeah. I mean, it very well could be, right? Like, it very well could be that they're responding to that local issue. You know, we don't call the Tosefta a local book, per se. You know, we don't know exactly from here, and this is where they... But yes, it could have been. Could have been a developing practice to which came this response. Let's look at... Oh, yeah.
It also occurs to me, maybe we're thinking as people of the age we are, about the Maranai issue, maybe what it's talking about isn't that the adults would either be confused or envious, but the slightly older kids who shouldn't be wearing shoes are the ones who would be confused.
Ah.
Because they could get the shoes by themselves.
Nice. But nice. So those kids who are even, like, ready to learn how to do the mitzvah might be confused.
And if, because it is something they can do on their own, you want to make sure they aren't doing that.
Nice. Nice perush. Let's look at now this page, back to our sandal page. I want to show you the beginning of the Gemara in the Babylonian Talmud. So the Gemara is going to express surprise at that term asur. Asur? Anush karethu. Asur? You're telling me these are only forbidden? I know from the Torah that there's a severe punishment called karet, meaning completely being cut off from your people. And you're just telling me they're asur? Forbidden? Amar Rabbi Ela ve'itema Rabbi Yirmia. Rabbi Ela says, and some say it was taught in the name of Rabbi Yirmia, lo nitzricha Ela l'chatzi shiur. No. I needed the Mishnah to teach me that these things were forbidden, because otherwise I might have thought that half of the amount of making a sin punishable by karet is not a sin punishable at all. As a matter of fact, it would be permitted me. That if I didn't eat the amount that is the threshold for karet, I wouldn't have to worry. But the Mishnah comes to teach me, asur. No, they are forbidden, even in the amount that you thought might have been permitted. Because I'm a person that knows the rabbinic system has at its core, yes, there's a sin, but I also know that there's a threshold amount that I have to eat in order to really be guilty of that sin. So it's imagining a world where you know what that kamut, you know what that amount is that you have to eat in order to be held accountable for that sin. And if I eat less than I know is the punishable offense, permissible. No, because the Mishnah says asur. And that's why you don't have the word chayav at the beginning of the Mishnah. I would have expected chayav. Eating any of that stuff would have led me directly to karet. But we know that if you try to eat less, you could have gotten away with it until the time that we told you, and we tell you outright in the Mishnah, asur, it's forbidden. Okay. But this chetzi shiur, this chetzi measure, look at the halachic note. Half measure. Okay, you see the... chetzi shiur? If one ate or drank less than a full measure on Yom Kippur, he is not liable to receive karet, although such an act is prohibited by Torah law. One who eats or drinks a half measure receives lashes by rabbinic decree. This ruling follows Rabbi Yochanan in his dispute with Reish Lakish. So I point out the note to you because it's a little bit of a summary of what the Gemara is going to talk about. It introduces the notion that I can take a seemingly straightforward law about not eating. I can define what I mean by not eating in terms of a certain amount of food. I can understand what half that measure is. I can propose that you might think it's permissible to eat that half measure until I make a ruling that it's forbidden. And I have to understand the category that it's forbidden with. And I have to know whether it's Doraita, it's Torah law forbidden, or it's Darabanan, a rabbinic level mitzvah that's at work forbidding me from eating that half measure.
So if it's a soul, why they establish the measurement system?
They do that. I mean, I want to put the question back in your lap. Why do you think they permit you
to
eat half the measure and not get cut off from your people, Ron?
I know why when you establish a law, you need to put measurement. Like if you cannot transport drugs, it cannot be without measurement
right.
of minimum...
No, but why do you think philosophically they permit? Because I'll give you my take. My take is that they understand what it means to be a human being, vis-a-vis not maybe Yom Kippur, maybe even on Yom Kippur. If I got up in the morning and my normal course of everyday life is to get up and have a coffee and I eat a piece of, let's see, what do I really want to eat? I'll say fruit. No, I'm going to say fruit. So I get up and I eat fruit. And today I got up, and even though last night I was by Kol Nidre, and I know, I get up, and I take a bite. Right? I take a bite. They don't want me to be cut off entirely. They want to have a little bit of a leeway, so I can't believe I just did this. Oh, it's less than a date spulk, and it's pit. It's us or Darabanan. Or Doraita, it's forbidden by Torah or by the rabbinic level, but I'm not cut off. I'm going to get lashes. There's a little bit of humanity in knowing you walk into a place, and for whatever the reason, you tried this or that, and you thought it was the right thing, kosher, but you took a bite of it, and you realize all of a sudden. Zelozit. That's not it. For that one bis, they want to have a shiur, they want to have a measurement, where you're not completely now guilty of the crime. So I think there's a little bit of that going on, the space of being a human being. And I think there's also a notion that maybe not everybody, but some of us, and in different times, we like to play by the rules. And we need to know what the rules are. And life is like that sometimes. We in order to play those board games, you know, you turn over the box top and you read the whole thing, and now we can have an interesting night of fun and games. I think that part of the rabbinic project is to provide some of that. That's the level of simcha that's within the mitzvah. For me, sometimes. It's simcha. It's fun.
You can manipulate.
You can manipulate, but that's the worst angels. The better angels, the fun angels, are, oh, this is the amount that I have to eat for matzah, so I'm going to get my matzah measuring board out, and I'm going to really measure that matzah. And I'm going to sit within 1 minute, and I'm going to eat that much matzah. You know, we talked about that when we learned Pesachim, when we learned this tractate about the Seder. That's fun to me. I think there's a little fun in that. The Gemara is going to go, and we're going to read the next little bit, and then we're going to pick up next week. Ha nicha, it's okay. This worked out well, according to the one Laman de'amar chatzi shiur asur min haTorah. The one who says that half of the measure that would make you guilty of the sin and be cut off from your people, For he who says, if you only eat half, you're not really over, you're not really transgressing the Torah law, if you eat only half the measure. You're not committing the sin, the one that's explained in Torah where you can get cut off from the people. But you are still doing something forbidden, and the authority who says what you're doing with the half measure and eating it is forbidden from the Torah, deoraita level status, hanichalo. He's fine. The word asur works in the Mishnah. So, it's not chayav. I'm not going to be cut off. There's not the word chayav, you're obligated to be cut off from your people. There's the word asur, it's forbidden. And if I have the reasoning behind this, that eating only half the measure is forbidden from a Torah level, directly from the Torah level, deraita, the Mishnah works out with that sage who thinks that way. We're now trying to, sometimes in the Gemara, we'll do this, we'll align the Mishnah with an approach of a sage. So the sage who says that a half measure is prohibited from Torah, by Torah law, b'seder. It's asur to eat half the measure, forbidden, and you're chayav karet, and you're obligated if you eat the full measure, as the second part of the Mishnah explained. Eila l'man de'amar chatzi shiur mutar min haTorah. But the one who holds that the Torah itself, on a deoraita level, does not forbid half of the amount. Ma'ikal ameimar. How do we get to the whole notion that it's forbidden? Meaning up top, at the top part of the Mishnah. Because if I don't think that eating half the measure is forbidden by the Torah, how could you possibly tell me the first Mishnah, asur v'achila? I have a problem. The Gemara is going to go on, and it's going to figure it out, and it's going to figure it out whether or not everybody agrees it's all deraita from the Torah, that you can't eat the half measure, or even the Rabbanan at a different level of mitzvah, it's forbidden to eat the half measure, and the implications if you eat the half measure, if it's Torahitic, deraita, or it's the Rabbanan just on a rabbinic level, in terms of a mitzvah. That technical problem or the technical issue never loses, in terms of its very technical kind of reality, never loses the overlay of the question, Ron, you presented, or the larger issue, what really, or the larger potential conceptual understanding, what really is the Talmudic project when it comes to providing you levels of thinking about performing mitzvot, not transgressing, not sinning, and fulfilling your obligations. And that's a broader philosophical discussion in terms of mitzvah observance and practice that's also at the heart of the very technical and rule-oriented discussion as to the half measures, the full measures, and whether or not they're deraita, derabbanan, Torahitic, rabbinic. Lila Tov.
Thank you.